me, but they won't admit. Thinking black on black, strange creature, how strange heaven fits. From my body house, I'm afraid to come outside. Although I'm filled with love, I'm afraid they'll hurt my pride. So I play the part I feel they want of me. And I'll pull the shades so I won't see them seeing me. Having hard times in this crazy town. Having hard times. There's no love to be found. Having hard times in this crazy town. Having hard times. There's no love to be found.
To the Illinois World Labor Hour, and it's the February 14th show, and the views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WFT, its board of directors, associates, station manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated. I'm your host, David Johnson, here with Tom Thomas and Bob Pelesny, and we got a special guest calling in the show today. His name's Peter Cole. He's a labor history professor from Macomb University off to the western part of the state. And he's going to be talking about African Americans in the labor movement. This is part of our series in honor of Black History Month. And Peter's going to be talking about a particular labor African-American labor leader named Ben Fletcher, who was the president of a very diversely ethnic diverse local of dock workers in Philadelphia between the period of 1910-1920. So it's a pretty fascinating story. So he'll be coming in about halfway through the hour. But in the meantime, we have some underwriting announcements. Tom?
The Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by the Illinois Education Association Teachers Union and the Central Illinois Jobs with Justice. Building coalitions amongst workers, unions, and the community, the Illinois Education Association and the Central Illinois Jobs with Justice are proud to support WEFT Community Radio in East Central Illinois. This hour of programming is also brought to you by the listeners of WEFT and by the Brotherhood of Maintenance Way. The Brotherhood of Maintenance Way employees are proud to continue their support for the Illinois World Labor Hour. A Democratic Union, BMWE, celebrates the voice for labor on WEFT. It is our hope that all workers may share the same benefits that we enjoy, such as living wages, job security, away-from-home expense pay, early retirement, Canadian-style health insurance, and guaranteed year-round work.
Yay for that Canadian-style health insurance.
Yes. All right. And also, finally, the Illinois Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois.
Okay, there's quite some interesting news stories here during the week, and Anyway, we're going to be having, just to let you know, kind of an upcoming show. Next Saturday, we're going to be having Harry Kelber from New York City call in. Harry called into our show back in the, I think, early spring, early mid-spring, and talked about his experiences during
the... Yeah, I don't remember when it was, but I do remember the show.
Yeah, during the Great Depression and stuff. And Harry's going to be calling in, and he's going to have some special news updates for us so that he wanted to communicate to us directly on the air. So, okay, Tom?
Okay, this week's headlines, the World Labor News headlines. Okay, cash-strapped consumers kept buying McDonald's burgers and breakfast items in January, helping the fast food chain post a 7.1% worldwide increase last week in same-store sales for the month. The nation's number one hamburger chain has been posting strong sales as the economic downturn in the U.S. spreads overseas and people turn away from pricier restaurants to grocery stores and fast food outlets. In the United States, sales at locations open at least a year rose 5.4%. Internationally, same-store sales rose 7.1% in Europe, led by sales in the U.K., France, and Russia. They rose 10.2% in Asia, in the Asia-Pacific region and the Middle East, and Africa. Okay, Illinois' new governor, Pat Quinn, has promised to review the Illinois state tollway system from top to bottom. Quinn said last week that the people of Illinois are depending on his administration to make sure that the tollway agency goes in the right direction. According to AP reports, the agency has had a revolving door of executive directors since the tollway boss resigned in September 2008. Two immediate successors left almost immediately, and a third interim head was appointed last week. The tollway agency also released a federal subpoena had obtained for records about contractors who had ties to former Governor Rod Blagojevich, who was removed from office January 29th after an impeachment trial that was triggered by his December arrest on federal corruption charges. The accusations against Blagojevich include alleged shady links to work on a $1.8 billion Chicago-area tollway construction project. Hey, it has been 10 months since the workers walked out of the Plain Low Slung factory in New Franklin, Ohio for the final time. The building, which had been home to the Manchester Tool Company since just after World War II, sits dormant now with a for sale or lease sign in front of it. The fallout of the plant's closure last year by Kennametal, a global conglomerate based in Latrobe, Pennsylvania, just a few months into the recession, continues to weigh heavily on the lives of more than 100 employees who lost their livelihoods. According to Bill Luplo, a 66-year-old worker who had worked on the shop floor of the industrial tool-making plant for some 45 years, some of us bounced back and some of us haven't. In fact, an examination by the New York Times of the fates of the laid-off workers found that less than 15% of the hourly workers actually had steady work almost a year later. Okay, oops. Got my stories jumbled up here. Okay, a plan to raise income taxes on wealthy New Yorkers is gaining momentum in the New York State Legislature as lawmakers struggle against the state's massive budget deficits. A group of Senate Democrats has introduced a bill that would impose an income tax of 10.3% on the highest-earning New Yorkers and would increase taxes on all households that earn more than $250,000 a year. Supporters estimate the plan could bring in up to $6 billion annually to depleted state treasury as an alternative to reductions in state social services. State legislators are under increasing pressure from the state's powerful labor unions and various liberal groups to raise taxes on the wealthy. Although an income tax increase for the state's highest-earning residents did pass in the state assembly last year, its upcoming fate in the Senate is less certain. The rich Republicans, who controlled the chamber until January, blocked the bill last year. However, with the Democrats now in control, the bill is standing a much better chance of passing, and when it does, perhaps it can serve as a model for 49 other states. And finally, according to Sharon Durbin, chief executive officer for Land of Lincoln Goodwill Industries in Springfield, which covers the Champaign branch, Champaign's Goodwill store at North Prospect Avenue and Sherwood Drive plans to move to a new location in the next few months. Bargain shoppers who frequent the Champaign Goodwill store will notice a for lease sign out front, but the store is not closing. The current 5,000-square-foot building is not big enough to accommodate the growing inventory of donations. It has no public restrooms, and there is no break room for employees and volunteer workers. The location also has a pretty limited parking area for the extent of business it does. Goodwill has been at the Prospect Avenue store since 1994 when it moved to that location from downtown Champaign. Ms. Durbin reports that the charity is now looking at three different sites, but could not say exactly where they were because negotiations are presently ongoing. Dave?
On Wednesday, the 28th of January, 2009, workers for Shaw's Construction Contractors at Lindsay Oil Refinery in North Lincolnshire, United Kingdom, were told by the shop stewards that the new contractor, IREM, an Italian company, that a part of contract on LOR's HDS3 plant had been awarded to, was refusing to employ British labor. IREM planned to house hundreds of Italian and Portuguese workers in accommodation barges in Grimsby Harbor, busing them to and from the plant every day. They were explicit in their policy of not hiring any British workers or contractors. With IREM was herding the Italian workers like cattle on a boat rumored to be a prison ship, keeping them well away from the trade unionized British workers. The entire LOR workforce from all subcontracting companies met and voted unanimously to take immediate strike action. The following day, over 1,000 construction workers from LOR, Conoco, and Easting sites descended outside Lindsay Oil Refinery's gate to picket and protest. Thus became one of the most remarkable episodes of industrial action in the United Kingdom since the uprising in the North Sea in the late 1990s. Workers the length of the United Kingdom began a series of unofficial and therefore illegal actions from Grangemouth Oil Refinery and Loganet Power Station, Scotland, Sellafield and Heysham Nuclear Plants, Fiddler's Ferry in Winds, and the Drax Power Station in Yorkshire. In just 3 or 4 days, the United Kingdom's anti-trade union laws, some of the most oppressive in Europe, were swept aside by workers in key industrial facilities, power generation, and oil refinery. Workers ignored and defied anti-union laws on balloting procedure, solidarity strikes, and mass picketing, exploding the myth perpetuated by far too many union leaders for decades that the anti-union laws invented by the Tories, the conservatives, and retained by New Labour are insurmountable. The strikers themselves agreed demands at their mass meetings, which never gained the oxygen of media coverage, but with cuts across entirely the vicious distortions of their portrayal in the press. They demanded union rights for all workers, including immigrant labor for union facilities, for the Italian workers to make them an integral part of the trade union movement here, and for the implementation of the National Construction and Engineering Industry Agreement on the rate for the job, hours of work, breaks, and conditions for all working in the United Kingdom, including the Italian and Portuguese workers. And Baba, did you have some news items?
I've got one news story here. Finally, after 54 days, the Senate committee approves Hilda Solis as labor secretary. The Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee today voted to send Hilda Solis' nomination for labor secretary to the full Senate for approval. Senators Pat Roberts, Republican of Kansas, and Tom Coburn, Republican of Oklahoma, cast the two no votes. It took 54 days since her nomination for Solis to get a committee vote compared to Bush's labor secretary, Elaine Chao, who was confirmed in just 18 days. The widely praised Solis was blocked by Senate Republican for her progressive views supporting American workers. A vote by the full Senate on the nominations is expected this week and can come as early as Thursday. Congress is scheduled to break for President's Day recess from February 16th to the 20th. And most labor and progressives and editorial boards and stuff are really praising her as going to do a good job for workers.
Well, I know I Googled her when I first heard her announcement, and I'd never heard of her before, but after doing some research on her, she's not just another politician. I mean, this woman's a real labor activist, and I'm surprised they didn't fight harder to try to keep her from being confirmed.
Well, part of the problem here again was her husband didn't pay some taxes again, and this has been a reoccurring theme for some of Obama's nominations.
Well, she can't help what her husband does. Also, I got the Labor's Voice for Change. A new rank and file labor organization is today announcing their endorsement of Leo Girard, president of the 850,000 member United Steelworkers, as their candidate for AFL-CIO president. Our choice of Girard for the AFL-CIO's top position is based on his outstanding record as an organizer, negotiator, and communicator whose influence extends to unions around the world. In his first 4 years as Steelworkers president, Girard launched a wide range of union initiatives that brought more than 350,000 workers into the union's ranks. Under the leadership, the Steelworkers Union has become the largest industrial union in North America. After graduating from high school, Girard went to work at the Inco nickel smelter company in Greater Sudbury, Ontario. He was elected steward and chief steward of a 7,000-member local union. Gerard's talents as an organizer and communicator helped him to rise steadily within the union hierarchy until 2002, when he was elected to his first full term as Steelworkers International President without opposition. Labor's Voice for Change is dedicated to promoting union democracy and the rights of union members. By its initiative, it is giving rank-and-file members a voice in choosing candidates for national office on the issues of deep concern to working families. The AFL-CIO convention will be held in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, September 14th through the 17th, 2009. And you can find more information, labor information in general, and about Labor's Voice for Change at their website, which is laborsvoiceforchange.org. And finally here, I've got something a little... on the humorous side, I got this. I saw this on the internet here. Ben and Jerry's ice cream created the Yes Pecan ice cream flavor for Obama. For George W. Bush, they asked for suggestions from the public, and here are some of the favorite responses from the public for an ice cream flavor dedicated to George Bush. Here are the ones that people submitted: Grape Depression, the Housing Crunch, Abu Grape, Nothing Accomplished, Iraqi Road, Chunky Monkey in Chief, Chalk and All, Impeach Cobbler, Heck of a Job Brownie, Rocky Road to Fascism, Chocolate Chip on My Shoulder, Credit Crunch, Mission Pecomplished, Bloody Sunday, Caramel Preemptive Stripe, and Good Riddance, You Lousy Mother... Swirl. I couldn't say that one word. So, so anyway, yes. Now, we as we said, we're going to be having a special guest call in here about half past the hour. Right now, we're going to do a little segment of Workers Independent News, and then we'll be hearing Tom Thomas's poem for the week, which this week is Who Wears the Crown? So, Workers Independent News.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. General Motors and Chrysler this week will present their plans for our future sustainability to the federal government. If the government isn't satisfied, billions of dollars in loans could be called in, forcing one or both companies into bankruptcy. Doug Cunningham files this report.
On Tuesday, GM and Chrysler will present their long-term financial plan to the U.S. Treasury Department as a condition of the multi-billion dollar loans they got from the government. United Auto Workers President Ron Gettelfinger says it's critical that the Obama administration deliver the help the industry needs to survive.
Millions of jobs will be lost in this country if we lose this industry.
Gettelfinger says union auto workers are not to blame for the industry's crisis.
Are we going to blame the auto workers who are, by the way, 10%? Of the cost of an automobile, or are we going to take a look at what's happened to our economy, to the housing crunch, to the Wall Street bailout and the failures on Wall Street? You know?
President Obama says he's ready to provide substantial aid to the auto industry, but they have to present him a plan that works. The economic stimulus bill provides a tax break for GM, nullifying an unintentional tax increase triggered by the federal loan that it received last year.
Toyota's slumping sales will likely have an impact on the Japanese automaker's U.S. plants. The company will cut production at U.S. plants starting in April and plans to shorten the work week by asking employees to work 8 hours less over a two-week period. According to the company, unionized plants in the United States will not be impacted by these plans. Plants that will be included in the new plan are in Indiana, Kentucky, and Texas. Buyouts will be offered to 18,000 workers, and the offer includes 10 weeks of pay plus 2 weeks of pay for every year of service, with a $20,000 bonus on top. The company also plans to cap salary increases for the foreseeable future. The streets of Rome were gripped by bodies of striking workers on Friday as finance members from the G7 gathered to discuss how to address the growing global economic crisis. Thousands of workers representing both metal workers and public sector workers took to the streets, waving red flags and demanding better contracts, job security, and tax increases on the rich. Nearly 700,000 workers took to the streets demanding that the government address their concerns. Workers at Australian paper The Morning Star plan to strike even after the paper warned it would close if they do. The workers will walk out for 1 day over a proposed pay raise, which, according to the union representing the workers, amounts to a pay freeze. Paper editor John Haylett said all the workers will secure if they walk off the job is Closure of the Morning Star.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Okay, and now we go to the Cultural Corner with Tom Thomas and his poem of the week, Who Wears the Crown?
Where big fish eat the little fish is the place that they call Wall Street, where cannibals devour hope and trample truth beneath their feet. It's run by a gang of the few, Illuminati they are called, a selfish, lying, thieving crew whose existence should be appalled. There are so many things to do before true liberty is ours, and we must do them together, growing together like flowers. Decriminalizing freedom would certainly be a good start, emboldening, building the dream that dwells in every righteous heart. Swinging sledgehammers through mountains, through fertile plains, through desert sands, we blaze the roads that carry us with sweat and blood in our bare hands. We working men and women built this nation that we love today. So why would we support tyrants who from us would take that away? Most workers who have lost their jobs are victims of the greedy schemes of button-pushing con men who don't care a bit about our dreams. Unemployment from corruption is a curse that we are bearing, but things are looking up somewhat. Our government seems to be caring. But still, we'll keep an eye on them and never let them shut us down. As long as your press remains free, it's the people who wear the crown. Who Wears the Crown was written at the Poets' Loft in Champaign, Illinois on February 13, 2009, and was first recited live today, February 14, 2009, on the Illinois World Labor Hour on WEFT 90.1 FM in Champaign, community radio for East Central Illinois. Thank you for listening. Thank you for your support.
Okay, a couple of public service announcements. The American Dream Down Payment Initiative, ADDI, is down payment assistance for first-time homebuyers. For more information, call the City of Urbana's Community Development Department about programs to help first-time homebuyers. You can call at 384-2335. That's 384-2335.
I've fallen and I can't get up. My door is locked. How will someone reach you? The Urbana Fire Rescue Service's residential Knox Box system may be the solution. The residential Knox Box allows firefighters to gain entry to your home to provide medical or lift assistance without damaging your doors or windows. For more information, call the Urbana Fire Rescue Services at 384-2420.
Okay.
Hey, what's up now?
Brother, what's up?
This is a big party, man.
There's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah. Father, father, we don't need. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate.
You know we've got to find a way
to bring some love in here today. Oh, picket lines and picket signs, don't punish me with
Okay, Tell Me What's Going On by Marvin Gaye. Anyway, we're expecting a call from our guest person that's going to be calling in, Peter Cole. And between now and then, time Peter calls, I just wanted to share this with you about the Wall Street bailout. It's from a man named Alan Benjamin who wrote this. Reads, finally someone in the mainstream media has the guts to tell it like it is. Writing in the New York Times, February 3rd, Paul Krugman notes that all of Obama's tough talk is just for show, quote unquote. Krugman was referring to Obama's strong denunciations in his weekly address of Wall Street CEO bonuses and his call for tougher restrictions on banks receiving government bailout aid. Why just for show, Krugman writes? Quote, we have a financial system that is run by private shareholders, managed by private institutions, and we'd like to do our best to preserve that system, says Secretary Treasurer Timothy Geithner as he prepares to put taxpayers' money on the hook for that system's immense losses. Meanwhile, a Washington Post report based on administration sources says that Tim Geithner and Lawrence Summers... Okay. Hello?
Hi, this is Peter Cole.
Peter, welcome to the show. Glad you could call in and everything. I guess we'll just start off why don't you tell us a little, introduce yourself a little bit, and then maybe we could start out by you could talk about what life was like for African-American workers in the early part of the 20th century.
Mm-hmm. At this moment, or you're saying, like, wait a few minutes?
No, go ahead and introduce yourself, and then you could go into the, start talking about what life was like for African-American workers in the early part of the 20th century.
Yeah, we're on the air now.
Yeah, we're on the air.
Oh, great. Hi. My name is Peter Cole. I teach U.S. labor history at Western Illinois University in Macomb, Illinois. I've written several books, and one of them is called Wobblies on the Waterfront, Interracial Unionism in Progressive Era Philadelphia, and also a shorter book by Charles H. Kerr Press out of Chicago called Ben Fletcher, The Life and Times of a Black Wobbly, and that also tries to explore Fletcher's role in Local 8 and the IWW, as well as sort of what people in the labor movement thought of Ben Fletcher, wrote about Ben Fletcher, those sorts of things.
Okay. Well, Ben Fletcher lived in a period in the first part of the 20th century. Can you tell us a little bit about what life was like in general for African-American workers at that time?
Sure. Philadelphia, of course, is both typical of, say, 1900 in America, but also, like every place, somewhat unique. We have the good fortune that W.E.B. Du Bois, the great African-American radical and intellectual, wrote his first book on Philadelphia called The Philadelphia Negro, and it came out in 1899. And he basically says that the overriding fact of life for black people in Philadelphia is racism, and that that pervades every aspect of their life, unfortunately, and in particular in the workplace, so that although Philadelphia actually had the largest population of black people outside of the South in America in 1900, they were confined to certain types of jobs, essentially screened out entirely of the very large industrial sector of Philadelphia's economy and forced into low-level manual labor, casual labor, which basically means sort of by the day, and domestic and or service work. That included both black men and black women. Most black women had to work outside of the home for wages. And so Ben Fletcher was born and raised in Philadelphia and the area, and so that would have been Ben Fletcher's life growing up in the 1890s and the first decade of the 1900s, was that there is a large number of African Americans in the city of Philadelphia and across the Delaware River in Camden, New Jersey, that the economy is doing pretty well from the late 1890s forward, but that blacks are excluded from many of the occupations of work.
Now, as far as the African-American workforce, I know there's always been African-Americans who've lived in the city of Philadelphia going back to the colonial times, but was there a certain period when a good number of African-Americans migrated from the South?
Definitely. There is a sort of a trickle of African-Americans, including Ben Fletcher's parents, who moved from Virginia into Philadelphia sometime in the late 1800s. That sort of steady trickle also involves blacks moving from rural South to urban Southern places. But then, as is well known, in the World War I era, 1915 onward, due to economic booms to support the war effort, first of the Europeans and then of the U.S., then hundreds of thousands of African Americans move out of the South into the North and Midwest, and tens of thousands move into Philadelphia within a very short time, just say from 1915 to 1920. There's an explosion in the population that is remarked upon by many, many people, and a lot of those folks ended up joining or finding work on the waterfront and joining Local H, but Fletcher predated that, right? He was born and raised actually in Philadelphia.
Okay. So was there always a dock workers union in Philadelphia? And also, were there other particular ethnic groups that were in Philadelphia and in particular on the docks?
The marine transport dock workers, or longshoremen, if you can use both those words comfortably, I think. There's always been a tradition of union activism on the waterfront. I think it is a lot to do with the type of work. It sort of breeds, I think, a notion of group solidarity as well as opposition to the employer or the boss. But there were no unions on the Philadelphia waterfront in the early 1900s. There had been attempts to organize unions in Philadelphia, but they had generally been very short-lived. And so the last effort had been in the early 1890s, and so then there was no efforts early mid-1890s until 1913 when the IWW showed up. So there was a desire and a history, actually, of workers trying to organize unions, but a history of failure, actually, to organize unions.
Okay. We know a lot of just general American labor history about how a lot of times various ethnic groups were at odds with each other over competition for jobs. Was that the case in Philadelphia at this time?
Oh, well, like Philadelphia is in a way sort of like the classic example of that, unfortunately. In the 1840s, say, a lot of the dock work had been done by African Americans and had been for many decades, but in the 1840s we see waves of Irish immigrants coming into America and Philadelphia and literally fighting with blacks often for work, as documented by other historians. By the mid-1800s, really, the Irish controlled the waterfront. By the late 1800s, that had somewhat changed again. There were some blacks on the waterfront. There were some Irish and Irish Americans on the waterfront. And then there was also a small but growing number of European immigrants, especially from, well, Lithuanians and Poles, although they were generally coming from the Russian Empire. And so what we see in 1913, on the dawn of the formation of the IWW Union, is roughly a waterfront that's one-third African-American, one-third Irish-American, and one-third immigrant from Europe.
So there's tensions still at this point in, by 1913 as far as competition for the jobs on the waterfront, on the docks in particular?
Yeah, there are tensions, and one of the reasons that waterfront workforce is so diverse is because employers understand that tensions exist, can be taken advantage of. So American society is very anti-black as well as very anti-immigrant, but also there's the workers themselves sort of inhale some of those prejudices, but then they are also often manipulated by employers who see a diverse workforce on the waterfront as an effective way to prevent unionization, the presumption being that people of different ethnic or racial groups won't be able to cross those divides and organize a common front.
And how did what was the techniques employers used to kind of encourage this competition and division?
Well, sometimes we know things from specifically Philadelphia and sometimes other places. There's some evidence that, according to interviews much later with Philadelphia longshoremen, that employers, gangs were generally segregated, and so although the workforce was diverse, a gang of, say, 10 to 20 men or 20 to 40 men would be all of one group. And so employers could play gangs off of each other very easily. For instance, if a ship has several hatches and that go down to the hold where cargo is stowed, you might have, say, a Polish gang on one hatch and a black gang on another, and employers can use, essentially, prejudices to take advantage to get workers to work harder as well as to sort of work, not see sort of a common interest against their employers, for instance. And so having ethnically segregated gangs was one method of dividing up workers and playing them off each other. which generally resulted in higher productivity, but not necessarily higher gains for workers, were another way that prejudices could be taken advantage of.
Well, in these circumstances, it sounds like it's in a way, a very unlikely situation to where these various ethnic groups could actually unify and form a union, much less to have an African American become their president. Could you talk a little bit about how that was that Ben Fletcher? Well, first of all, how the IWW dock workers were formed and how Ben Fletcher became the leader of that local?
Of course. Well, the IWW had been in Philadelphia for some time. It's one of the big industrial cities in America at that time, and so a natural place for Wobblies to try and organize workers. There are a lot of different industries, and so actually the Wobblies had been organizing among textile workers, which is the largest industry in Philadelphia then.
That was about the time when the IWW was first forming, too, because it came about in 1905.
Yeah. Right, so in 1905, the IWW was founded. There's evidence of Wobbly organizing in Philadelphia within just 1 or 2 years after that.
Now, this was... As far as American labor unions at this point in time, weren't most unions segregated?
Yes. The exception was the union that allowed blacks rather than the norm. You should just work on the assumption that if a union existed, that it didn't allow blacks in, or at best, that it tolerated them in what we would call Jim Crow locals, segregated all black locals. The American Federation of Labor generally operated on that principle. But independent unions had a lot of latitude, so it really didn't matter what the AFL said. It mattered what the independent unions, that was where the power lied.
Okay.
And most unions were categorically racist.
Mm-hmm. Except now when the IWW was formed in 1905, they had a policy, didn't they, against racism from the day one?
One of the many reasons that the people who formed the IWW didn't like the existing labor movement was its prejudices.
Mm-hmm.
And it believed that the greater goal was to form a one big union, a union of all workers, and that why would we divide each other up based on our religious beliefs or our sex or our race? That simply played into the hands of employers. By the same token, also of the type of work we did, you know, so whether we were skilled labor or unskilled labor. So the Wobblies' criticisms of the existing labor movement were many, and the fact that they didn't allow African Americans in, as well as many immigrants, was one of the central criticisms. That's why the first article of the IWW Constitution basically says that no one can be denied admittance based on sort of color or creed or nationality.
That was quite progressive, if not shockingly progressive at the time, wasn't it? I mean, at this point in time?
Definitely. They're not the only folks out there who are speaking such or having such thoughts, but the IWW is, if not unique, is almost unique. It is an incredible union. It's not the first union to be inclusive. The Knights of Labor was the first national union that was really sort of open to
mm-hmm.
different people, but the Knights had been destroyed largely in the late 1880s, and in a way the Wobblies are the heirs to the Knights of Labor, but they also add a number of different ideas to what the Knights of Labor, they're not simply the son, but they are, they inherit some of those ideas, like the motto of the Knights was an injury to one is a concern of all. The Wobblies is an injury to one is an injury to all, right? And
mm-hmm.
so perhaps more inclusive than the Knights, but the Knights pointed the way.
Okay. So under these circumstances, this seems like almost an insurmountable happening. I mean, so how did all these workers, these different ethnic groups in Philadelphia get together and
it's
form?
Incredible. But I should just quickly mention one other fact, is that there's massive labor surpluses on the docks, which also plays into the hands of the bosses, because if unions get organized, why not simply fire the lot of them and replace them entirely with a new labor force, which was possible
mm-hmm.
because of massive migration from rural parts of America to cities, as well as from Europe to the United States. And so, yes, the odds are tremendous, and I would think that there's a number of reasons why Local 8 gets formed. One is that the ideology of the IWW is up to the task. They are not only inclusive to people of different backgrounds and different types of work, they're also very militant. And in an America where class conflict was the norm and where it was not uncommon to watch bosses fire people simply for talking union, or the police breaking people's heads for the same thing. You need a union that's going to sort of basically be strong and fight literally sometimes. And the Wobblies was that sort of organization. It did need also strong leaders as well as strong ideas. And the Wobblies did have a number of very well-spoken, highly committed, passionate organizers. One of those was Ben Fletcher, but he's not the only one. But Ben Fletcher is important because he is the only African-American among the leadership in the IWW in Philadelphia. He's already a Wobbly. He's already sort of joined the cause. And so although actually in the written record, he is not present, he is invisible in the initial strike,
mm-hmm.
we can assume that as a black longshoreman who is in the IWW and already an organizer, that he is playing an important role, but his absence is frustrating for historians like myself.
Okay.
We want to be able to know certainty. Like, we can make guesses, educated guesses, but mm-hmm. Fletcher doesn't appear in the written record in May 1913, and I can only give you smart guesses.
Sure.
But you know, you have a workforce that is multiracial, and the IWW immediately embraces that. For instance, in the initial bargaining that goes forward with some of the employers, there's a strikers committee that is one African-American, one Polish immigrant, and one Irish-American. That's exactly like the Wobblies' role in Lawrence, Massachusetts the year before in the famous Bread and Roses strike, where their negotiating committee had members from every ethnic group on it to make sure that every interest was represented and that people wouldn't feel that they were being excluded from decision-making.
Okay. And another contemporary at this time, A. Philip Randolph, who most people are aware of, was the founder of the Sleeping Car Porters Union. And but a lot of people don't know. And in fact, it almost seems like it's an intentionally buried and covered up history of A. Philip Randolph. In A. Philip Randolph's early years, basically during the 19-teens and stuff, he was quite a radical. I mean, him and the Chandler Owen, I think his name was, had a newspaper that they published.
Yeah.
And at one point, they were, both Randolph and Chandler were actually brought up on charges of treason and sedition because they advocated for African Americans in particular, but the working class in general, not to join and fight in World War I. But what did I noticed in one of your notes you sent me that A. Philip Randolph had was aware of local 8 dock workers in Philadelphia and about Ben Fletcher as well.
Yeah,
is that
that's
the case?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
He's slightly younger, and he is lives in Harlem in New York. He moved there in the early 19-teens and lived there for then quite a while. But Randolph and Owen have this monthly magazine called The Messenger, which subtitled "The Only Negro Radical Monthly in America," I believe is their masthead. And they are they're looking essentially, I would say, for how to connect the African-American community with a left-wing politics. They're both members of the Socialist Party, and the obvious place for anyone in that time would look would be the IWW. And although the IWW preached equality, it didn't in many places have a large black membership. Philadelphia did. And so the Messenger wrote a number of articles in the late teens and early 20s on Ben Fletcher specifically, as well as the union that he was part of, and essentially endorsed the IWW principles of inclusive unionism and industrial unionism. In a way, the language is very similar to the language of the CIO in the 1930s, even though actually Randolph's Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters remained in the AFL, which is a whole other story, I guess. But yeah, Randolph was a big fan of Fletcher, wrote a number of highly sort of praiseworthy essays in his magazine on him. And in the book I write, Ben Fletcher, it collects a lot of those documents as well as others from Randolph, to Fletcher. I don't know if they ever met, although I assume that they met, but I have no, again, sort of correspondence that confirms that they actually had conversations in the same room, but they must have. That's another frustration for me.
Okay. Well, it's just amazing to me still how a diverse ethnic workforce like existed in Philadelphia, being played against each other by the employers, were able to find, and also, you, as you said, that there was a lot of labor surplus as well. And you throw all these conditions in here, it just seems very unlikely that a union would have formed. Can you tell us a little about that? What if there was any kind of evidence of how this happened? Was there a particular incident, or was it just this happened slowly over time, or what exactly?
Well, in May 1913, the workers go on strike. They join the IWW, and then the IWW essentially introduces their ideas to this workforce, and this workforce embraces them. The IWW never signed contracts with employers.
They didn't sign contracts?
Never.
Really?
How
did they get wages and their benefits and working conditions?
Well, the Wobblies believe that the power of workers ride on the job, and that power would be essentially sacrificed if you voluntarily didn't strike for a period of years of a contract, and almost all contracts today have a no-strike clause. And so the Wobblies basically said, well, you know, life's about power. Employers want to insert their power over us and we over them, and so we will strike if we have to. And on any number of occasions, most of which have been lost to history because they were never written down, they go on strike, you know, and so there are thousands of members of the union. If, say, a boss hires a gang that has half Wobblies and half non-Wobblies, or, say, slightly different, two-thirds, one-third, you know, Wobblies wait an hour or two until into the shift. Everyone who's looking for work has gone home because hiring happens only on certain periods of the day. And then the workers go up to the boss and say, hey, you know, fire the rest or make them join the Wobblies or we're walking. And like I said, on any number of occasions, the threat or the actual strike forces employers to agree to Wobbly demands. And ultimately, the shape-up, which is the chaotic hiring method that benefited employers, was eliminated.
And that's well documented in the film On the Waterfront with Marlon Brando, of course.
Mm-hmm, right, the method of the shape-up, which exists in other ports then and after them. But for a few years in Philadelphia, basically, employers would call up the local union hall and say, we need these workers. And so even though they hated the Wobblies, they used Wobblies exclusively after a couple of years because the Wobblies had basically taken over the waterfront and had convinced workers to join them one way or another. Okay. Once there are new people who show up on the waterfront, well, you join the local because that's the path to getting a job on the dock.
Okay. So Ben Fletcher, initially he's already a Wobbly before the actual organizing of the dock workers in Philadelphia. He's an organizer. So eventually, though, rises to the position of president of the dock workers union. Can you talk a little bit about maybe how that happened and what happened of note when he was president?
Sure. The Wobblies also had very strict notions of democratic rule of unions, and so union leaders could only serve for 1 year, and then they had to rotate out. And they also never got paid more than anyone in their own, basically in the line of work. And so there was no incentive also for, say, the union leadership to remain, because they're not getting rich off the backs of their members anyway. So Fletcher was occasionally the head of Local 8, but he also was an organizer for the IWW, and he would travel frequently to other ports where there were African-American workers in particular, from Boston all the way down to Norfolk. But when Fletcher was in power, I don't have specific examples of things that occurred that he did, but while the Wobblies were in power during the World War I years, they integrate the gangs, they end the shape-up, they integrate their leadership. They also, for instance, mandate essentially that at meetings where they would have people serve as a chair of the meeting, secretary of the meeting. They also mandated essentially what we would call a quota system, where certain positions would have to be filled by African Americans and certain positions by other folks. And so they essentially instituted a form of interracialism by law. And so what happened under Fletcher's watch when he was the president of the local, I can't say, but these are the sorts of things that happened while Fletcher and other African Americans and other European Americans who are all in power all remain committed to. By the end of Local 8's run, actually, the union is majority black, which is interesting.
Okay.
Why is that? That transition occurs, I again can't say. Yeah, I don't think that sort of white workers are getting pushed out. My guess is actually during the World War I era is that whites have other options for work and move out of the docks, while African Americans, part of this great migration, are actually moving into this city more. And immigration will stop during the war years, and so the percentage of European immigrants in working class will decline relative to its pre-war. And so for a series of factors, we see essentially the demographics increase so that there's a majority of African Americans in the Union by the early 1920s.
Okay. Now, the from what I gathered from reading some of your research, too, online, is that the IWW also did organizing work in other countries, including Africa. Did mm-hmm. you want to just briefly talk about that, and then we're going to have to kind of wrap things up here?
Yeah, I'd love to. You know, the Wobblies were international. Their name, Industrial Workers of the World, suggests as much. Many people who worked as sailors were Wobblies, and they brought their ideas with them to Australia and New Zealand, to the UK and continental Europe, to Latin America, and perhaps most surprising, to South Africa through the port of Cape Town. There were Wobbly chapters in Johannesburg, which is the interior, but also during and after World War I, Wobblies and unions that were like the Wobblies but weren't officially IWW branches, but basically preached the exact same thing and were originally brought into the country by Wobblies, organized the first Black African Union in South Africa, which is an amazing thing. There's so the first unions that had blacks and also some whites in them were inspired by the IWW. Actually, the communists would come to embrace an inclusive ideology, although at that time they're not. So in a very racist nation, a country actually that has much in common with the USA, the first union to be fully inclusive was the IWW, just like in the United States.
Okay, Peter. Well, listen, thank you so much for calling in today. And this is a really incredible and inspiring story. And I'd love to, you know, I'd like to recommend your book, Wobblies on the Waterfront, I think is the name of it. And
yep.
How does a person order that book?
Oh, well, it's real easy. You can go to online booksellers like Powell's, which is union shops, and order it, Wobblies on the Waterfront. If you hit it on Black or Google, you will easily find ways to buy my book.
Okay, well, great. Thanks again for calling in, Peter. And
thank you.
You have a good day.
Yeah, bye now.
Bye.
I'll be better. Get some of that bass. Quaking, body shaking, upper decking, brains are wrecking, clock dogging, chuck rocking, flavor, neck shaving.
It's another record jacket madness to put my brothers and sisters on a deathbed. You know he cheated, took what he wanted, and now you bought it. Sucking up to the devil, stepping down a level. It's who they fear is you, who protects us from us and you from you. Yes, and it counts.
The 40 ounce.
I sued those bastards, yeah, they got bounced. I did them like a demo, threw them out the window. I took a 98, cause I never liked a limo. But pump, 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 pump it up. A man grinds for mad times, that's what's up. Some ain't gonna change, I got them in the range. I gotta rearrange, so I'm building back your brain. Wrecking records with focus stuff. Am I loud enough?
Yeah.
You got to
Okay, that was Public Enemy, and Give It Up. I thought I'd play that in honor of IWW dock workers in Philadelphia back in 1910-20. I'm sure that was probably, they could have possibly been singing that, of course, under a ragtime tune to the employers, you know,
they
as far as wanting more money.
Up,
give it up, give
stood.
It up. Give up the money to us. Okay, Bob, you had another short news story here before we take off?
Yeah, the economy delivered some good news for a change Thursday. Government reports said retail sales rose in January and new claims for unemployment benefits fell in the latest week. The number of first-time applicants for jobless benefits dropped to a seasonally adjusted 623,000 from a figure of 631,000 the previous week. The four-week average of claims, which smooths out fluctuations, rose 24,000 to 607,500, first time that figure has topped 600,000 in the current recession. In a sign that laid-off workers are having difficulty finding new work, the number of people claiming benefits for more than 1 week rose to 4.81 million, the highest total since records began in 1967. The continuing claims data lags the new claim numbers by a week. And a year ago, initial claims stood at 339,000, so there's been quite an increase there in 1 year. And retail sales unexpectedly rebounded, likely boosted by post-holiday discounts and providing a glimmer of hope for the recession-hit economy. The Commerce Department said total retail sales rose 1%, advancing for the first time in 7 months after slumping a revised 3% in December. And January's increase in retail sales was the biggest since November of 2007.
Okay. Well, I tell you, it's some of the other things in the economy that aren't looking too good. And I was glad to see that the stimulus package passed, even though I still don't understand why it is when the Republicans are in, they can just ram things through, get almost everything they want, and then the Democrats get control of the House, the Senate, and the presidency, and they've got to play let's make a deal and get, you know, they're... their hands tied behind their backs.
Too many gangsters in office.
Well, it's corporate money, Tom. It's all corporate money. Corporate. It's a
CEOs
structural problem.
Gangsters?
Well, I'm talking about CEOs giving money directly to politicians, and both parties are guilty of it, Democrats
that's
and Republicans,
sure.
And that's the problem. I mean, we've got, you can count on two hands the number of decent congressmen in the House and the Senate that don't take any corporate money. Very, very few.
And that's only if you get a couple fingers missing.
Good point, Tom. Anyway, okay, that's all for the only World Labor Hour for this week. We'll see you next week where we'll have a special guest calling in, Harry Kelber. And next is Bard Diverse.